The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon. Peter Robbins is one of America's most respected investigative writers specializing in the subject of UFOs, or UAPs, I should say. He is a regular guest on American and UK radio and podcasts. And has appeared as a guest on and been consultant to numerous television shows and documentaries. He has appeared on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens, Britain's Roswell, Unsolved Mysteries, as well as other shows, too numerous to mention here. He's been involved in this field for more than 30 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. Robbins has lectured extensively both in the States and abroad. Now, these have included local, national, and international conferences, as well as presentations for a variety of public service groups, seminars, public, private, and secondary schools, universities, businesses, libraries, scientific organizations, and educational foundations. We've had the privilege of having Peter as a guest on We Are Not Alone in the past, and we're happy to welcome him back after his presentation at the 2022 MUFON International Symposium in Denver, Colorado. So with that, hello, Peter.
Welcome. Hi, David. Back. It's good to be back with you.
Welcome back. So, the topic of your presentation at the MUFON Symposium was the origin of UFO ridicule, how America's greatest newspapers helped perpetuate America's greatest deception. Give our listeners a teaser about that, would you?
Sure. I don't think any of us that have followed an interest in the UFO, UIP subject that it's not crossed our minds at one point or another that this cultural phenomena that was kind of born with the modern age of UFOs in 1947 of kind of reflexively associating anybody that says something like, I saw something in the sky or some things in the sky that I had never seen before that maneuvered in ways I couldn't associate with conventional aircraft, that behaved in a manner I had never experienced before, and I wonder what they were. In a logical world, free of ridicule, I think most rational people would either say or think words to the effect of, gee, that's interesting, I wonder what it was too. So how did it happen that we got wired up with, up until a few short years ago, immediately in Western civilization, going to the conclusion that this individual is obviously delusional, wants attention, is trying to scam me in some way, is looking to become well known in this kind of quirky way, is lonely and looking for attention, or is some kind of mystic. It's so counterintuitive, David. It makes no sense whatsoever to the logical mind. And I kept coming back to the subject over the decades and finally decided some years ago to try to chase down and quantify how this happened. And I think to a great degree, I have accomplished that. And the paper that I gave basically laid out my thoughts on it and how it took place.
Very good. And how did that take place? You say all of these things, you know, in a perfect world, none of these things that none of these arguments that the skeptics have had makes any sense. And yet they go ahead and make their claims anyway.
A several-pronged kind of situation. Immediately, as the Kenneth Arnold report started to make its way onto the wire services, and less than a week later, something crashed on the plane some dozens of miles from what was then a small town in New Mexico called Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
Major media reported it in a sarcastic, condescending, dismissive way, and offered up illogical, sometimes nonsensical, pseudoscience explanations that ran the gamut from mass hallucinations to misinterpretations of conventional phenomena, which of course is a real explanation for a great deal of UFO activity, to pressure changing within the eyeball, to car lights on clouds, to war jitters, as they called, as they're moving into the Cold War, and literally never took seriously or did any kind of investigation of the possibility that in the, to paraphrase the words of our old friend, Stanton T. Friedman, that some, not all, but that some UFOs do in fact represent advanced technology from parts unknown, under intelligent control, coming and going for reasons best known to themselves. I read not just hundreds of articles over the years from the especially early weeks, months, and days of UFO coverage starting at the beginning, but ultimately more than 1,000 articles from every imaginable news source that you could name, and observed a very strong pattern of this initial, somebody says X, but of course it couldn't be that because that doesn't exist. And that's just, you know, the imagination of people who believe science fiction is real. And honestly, by the end of July of 1947, major media, and major media then was almost, well, was in overwhelming part newspapers with radio as the next level down, that major media had done such a good job of basically setting up the scenario that if you take this seriously, you're either a fool or naive, wishing for, you know, again, some science fiction scenario, or have no idea about the technological aspects of, you know, the fact that we're now testing our own V2 and V3 rockets that we captured from the Germans, and that's what you're really seeing, or that it's some kind of secret Soviet weapon over the United States, moving at 1,700 miles an hour.
Yeah.
That was sort of the first thing that I saw. And in fact, it worked so well that no publisher, editor, or reporter in major media seemed to question it. I think in great part because they didn't want to look foolish. And that was the way that the game was played. But why did every newspaper in America and all the major broadcast networks take that point of view rather than, gee, this is interesting. We have credible citizens, military people, commercial pilots reporting these phenomena. Of course, they didn't have access to the declassified documents we do now. And of course, we know how seriously our military and intelligence communities took this subject back then. But ultimately, I was able to deduce, and I think laid it out in a convincing form in this paper, that this was not some kind of coincidence, that surely there had to be some kind of official encouragement to take this point of view. I then go on to look at where America was at that moment in history and why, in fact, it served the interests of those in power to create this false scenario. Imagine for a moment, and your listeners as well, that Harry S. Truman, who was a tough son of a gun and a very independent thinker, after listening to everything that all of his insider consultants and advisors had to say, after 6 months of examination of the UFO situation, said, you know what, the hell with it. I'm going to go on radio and I'm just going to say what I think and let the chips fall where they may. And let's say, hypothetically, sometime in early 1948, the President of the United States goes on the radio and says, my fellow Americans, it's my solemn duty to let you know that after careful study, my advisors and I feel that some of these flying saucer phenomena may represent other intelligences from elsewhere in technology that we can't touch. We will continue to keep you appraised of our study and, you know, God bless America and all the rest of it. Can you imagine how differently our world might have evolved if the human consciousness was hit with a statement of that very simple factual thinking, which, you know, was governed by logic, although it was never, you know, publicly uttered, then where we find ourselves now? It's a lot to take in.
Well, it pretty much has been said, not by the president, not by a president, been hinted at by several presidents.
Sure.
You know, read between the lines. I'm not going to say anything. But read between the lines, here it is. but the Congress, not the Congress, but the Pentagon, the Navy, and some of the Air Force pilots, at least, have admitted that that these are real. And our, not ours, not America's technologies, they are either, now this is the scary part, the foolish part, I think. There are many foolish parts involved here, but one foolish part, they say they're not our technology. They're either Russian, Chinese, or other.
Sure.
Other meaning extraterrestrial. And I've asked this of other guests, what would you rather it be, Russian, Chinese, or extraterrestrial?
Well, number one, we're talking apples and oranges here. This was in 1947, and it wasn't the Chinese back then, and it really wasn't. It couldn't have been the Russians. They did not have the technological capacity any more than we had to create this kind of flight characteristics and machinery. Right. Also, you remind me that great old phrase, denial is not just a river in Egypt. And a very favorite quote when we're talking about people who were president or were running for president or people high up in the military intelligence and academic communities who we're seeing more and more of now. But for Americans, especially back in 1947, more innocent times, the president, as opposed to somebody that knew the president or worked with the president or was considering being president, is reminiscent for me of one of my favorite Mark Twain quotes. The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug.
Really? Really?
And so, you know, the way I look at the birth of our national security state, which God knows we're in and deep, it did not begin with guarding the secrets of the nuclear bomb. That's part of the mythology of post-war history. It began with guarding the secrets in great part of what we didn't know about this phenomena. And the very all too human ego-driven embarrassment of these otherwise powerful white men in Washington who were at the top of their form, who had directly or indirectly in many cases taken part in making the world quote-unquote safe for democracy with the defeat of fascism and Nazism in Europe. The Marshall Plan was in place, a remarkably visionary plan. I don't think it ever happened on that level in history, to use billions of our dollars to help our former enemies rebuild their economies, their governments, right, and their cultures. Right. And when was the last time Japan or Germany declared war on anybody? So for starters, that grain of sand that was the irritant in the Truman administration, we can't let people know about this. In the same way that a oyster forms a pearl, that sand is irritating and it creates calcification and builds layers of calcification. With every layer, it's less irritating because it's got no sharp edges. And at the center of our national security state, going back to 1947, is that piece of sand, and now a pearl, you know, that's as big as Utah. And that's what we're stuck with. And it's beginning to unwind now, I think, in a very stage-managed way, although a lot of folks are very pleased that the government is paying any attention to it at all, and I am too. But let's look at all the things they're not talking about, won't talk about, and if they have their way, we'll never talk about.
Right. I need to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with author and researcher, investigative writer, Mr. Peter Robbins. And Peter, tell me, what is your take on the recent congressional hearings on UAPs?
Well, number one, when they were first announced, like anybody with a long-time interest or a short-time interest in the field, I was curious, I was optimistic, and of course have been paying careful attention every step along the way. A year ago this month, I believe, the report was released in two versions. A redacted version for the general public and a more detailed, we can imagine, still classified version to senators, congressmen, I'm sure members of the Joint Chiefs, cabinet level people, advisors to the president, etc. What we were told revolved in great part around this aspect of UFO studies that has kind of sucked up a great deal of the oxygen in the room for the last 5 years, the 2004 Navy incidents referred to as the Tic Tacs. And it's almost as if that's when everything started, when in fact it started many years earlier. But to those uninformed and unaware of UFO history, understandably, because the New York Times had now sanctioned that this was a serious subject, major media agreed with the Times, broadcast, podcasts, networks, every news service imaginable on both the conservative, the liberal, and sort of middle of the road venues, that what I began to see was, first, in a very good way, that now that it seemed to be understood that if you step forward as a public person and said, I take this seriously, you're not going to destroy your career. You're not going to be the subject of ridicule from colleagues in the general public. And that is a big change.
Major step.
It is, and it's very healthy. At the same time, what we were told, for people like you and me, there was nothing new in there. And there was, at the same time, for me, a sense that we could tell you a lot more, but we're not going to now. We're not even happy that we're telling you this, but our hand has been forced. The ridicule factor no longer works to shut people up. And so the cat's out of the bag. Over the last years with the internet and so many people with an interest in this subject doing their own homework. Again, the internet, as we know, is a very double-edged sword. And for every piece of valuable information, there's twice as much crap, specious nonsense, and conspiracy-driven, completely unsubstantiated information, disinformation.
Right.
So, again, what I began to see was something that, on one level, was healthy. There was a discourse going on, that there was an admission on the part of official circles that some of this stuff that we've been poo-pooing for years, we need to take seriously. Mm-hmm. Coming out of that, I saw something which I considered particularly healthy, and I hope that it continues to grow, namely that in our incredibly divisive political reality that we live in now, with the extremes getting more extreme, with politics being seen almost as a sporting event that's all about winning and losing, mm-hmm. and forgetting that a good part of our democratic republic, the ideals thereof, were built on this idea of compromise, something that we grew up observing regularly in government circles, and more often than not, with pronounced figures who are liberal or conservative, in the dictionary definitions, that Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, ideological opposites, were friends and had cordial exchanges. Teddy Kennedy and Ronald Reagan were particularly close friends in private, something that caught me off guard when I learned about it some years ago in a very compelling interview with Nancy Reagan. Mm-hmm. She and Ronald Reagan really loved Teddy Kennedy, which would horrify most hardcore conservatives, but they exchanged kindnesses with each other's families and themselves over the decades. Mm-hmm. I'm off on a tangent here. What I'm saying is that right now, for example, on the right, for lack of a more descriptive term, we have the senator from Florida, Marco Rubio, standing up regularly and making clear his dissatisfaction with this outdated policy that goes back to 1947 and the need for more openness, and that we the people need to know. At the other side, in the progressive circles, one of my congressional representatives, Kirsten Gillibrand, who is a smart, sharp woman and credentialed a politician as anybody out there, man, woman, doesn't matter, who also started to take the subject extremely seriously and kind of went one beyond Senator Rubio in obviously seeking out knowledgeable people and putting together a proposal for a permanent study group within Congress that runs like 140 pages or something. It's incredibly well thought out and incredibly detailed. Number one, neither of these elected representatives felt that it was going to endanger their jobs or careers to take a stand on this. Mm-hmm. Number two, they found common ground on something, which we desperately need in our political reality in this country, or we're going to pull each other apart. And again, paraphrase Benjamin Franklin, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately. This country is on a collision course with itself. And this issue may be something that can help bring us together.
And I haven't seen any, anyway, I've seen or heard any backlash from either person you mentioned or anyone in politics that have that has come out and talked about the UAP phenomenon since they've come forward in the Pentagon and
I don't think there's been any, David. Certainly none that's made its way to the public. And that's a very good thing.
Yeah. So there were two top Pentagon officials, Ronald Moultrie and Scott Bray, who testified at this congressional hearing. And Mr. Bray, Deputy Director of Navy Intelligence, stated that they had no material in their possession to suggest that it was anything other than of terrestrial origin. Do you think he was lying or simply kept ignorant of what materials were actually had been recovered?
Great question. Number one, I think that sort of antiquated notion that we're looking for element X, you know, that this, we found a piece of metal that doesn't exist on Earth, that no amount of forging or fabricating or combining different alloys could be produced. I think that's sort of a false trail. I also think that even in the higher echelons of need-to-know secrecy, there are people who are, you know, have top secret and above clearances, but not that particular top secret and above clearance. The left hand, as they say, not knowing what the right hand is doing.
Right.
Absolutely anything is possible. And I think some folks who look at people like us with a wry smile and say, gosh, you know, what are these grown-ups spinning their wheels about this? It's so unlikely. At the same time, it's very likely that a huge amount of UFO-related phenomena for some decades now is explainable in conventional / unconventional terms.
Right.
I remember some years back when they began testing drones in Nevada, early regular folks' photos of these things, at least momentarily, captured the attention of a lot of us in the UFO research community, because we had never seen anything like this before.
Right.
And, you know, shortly thereafter, we were appraised that these things, and up until then, you know, they were small, almost child's toys, were now, some of them airplane size, could go for thousands of miles, could be used for spying, observation, killing people.
Killing, yeah, military.
Also that, you know, for me, one of the great things to go back to is that simple text on the great old X-Files poster. I want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to believe something or not believe it. We all have longings that for some people revolve around the idea that we have made such a mess of this planet. We have overpopulated it. We have poisoned it. We have contributed to such a dramatic change in the climate that you and I will not live to see it. But this may be a science fiction scenario in less than 100 years where people are burning alive. I mean, look at what's happening with temperature in certain parts of the world starting around this time of year. We have friends who are having to deal with 110, 120 degrees, and that ain't good. Electric grids are getting stressed out. What I'm saying here is it's natural to long for. And Carl Jung talked about this in the 1950s in his book about flying saucers, which I think some people are not aware that he wrote about it. The idea of human longing for a new technologically savvy bunch of gods to help us out of the predicament that we've gotten ourselves into. Mm-hmm. And you know what? They're not coming. I also think that in the hyper-specific arguments and discussions around this subject, people forget that first, there's a myriad of explanations for UFO-related phenomena, as we know, mm-hmm. and some of them have nothing to do with technology. It may be very ethereal. It may be interdimensional. Certainly, an aspect of it is caught up in consciousness. And if there is an extraterrestrial civilization capable of the kind of technology that we're seeing, there may be quite a number of them coming and going, each one with a different relationship or lack of relationship with humanity, mm-hmm. with different aims and histories with our little planet, who may have been here right beside us all these, you know, millennia, one dimension away, or
I believe it.
Bases under the ocean and under the ground.
I believe.
And so, you know, I'll conclude this little part of this rant with the wonderful parable about the six blind men and the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
One's got his arms wrapped around the leg, another the tail, another's touching the trunk, another's feeling the ear, another is, patting the side of the elephant, the other one's holding the tusk, and they're arguing with each other that the other ones are all wrong. Because they know what the elephant is. They're making contact with a part of it that they assume represents the whole, when it doesn't at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is true. Well, I think that the Pandora's box, shall I say, has been opened.
Yes.
With these congressional hearings, with the Pentagon making their statement, and more and more people, like you say, politicians coming forward,
yeah.
and not being ridiculed. And our press,
yeah.
Very little do you see any skepticism in our press anymore.
Yes.
And it's like I say, Pandora's box has been opened. And more questions are going to come forward, you know, and demands for knowledge beyond what they have stated.
I'll take it one step further and say, with that Pandora's box, when you lift the lid,
yeah.
you find is 100 other lids.
Yeah.
The parable about the riddle wrapped in the enigma, etc. I think one thing that we can look forward to, although maybe that is the wrong spirit of wording, is that we can, if the government, for lack of a better term, has its way, we will see more reports to follow. Each one pondering maybe a little bit more, a little more courageously, a little more imagination, a little more fact, but it will all be stage managed. And you can bet every cent that you have that they will not be talking about anything remotely exotic. The possibility of a crash of one of these objects, of a retrieval, of back engineering, of UFO-related abduction, of hybrids, of missing pregnancies. They're not going to address that at all. And careful study over the years for a number of us who have specialized in such areas suggests a likelihood that is as real as the chair that I'm sitting on, as far as I'm concerned. Then again, I was in the unusual position of working as Bud Hopkins' assistant for many years and spending time with and seeing case histories of and physical evidences and family histories and multiple witnesses and scarification of certainly several hundred of the more than 800 people that Bud dealt with professionally in his career as the pioneering father of scientific study of the abduction phenomena. And I don't expect other people to, you know, have my point of view on it necessarily. But again, this idea of it being stage managed will go on. And more people, hopefully, will do their best to rattle the cage. Different elected officials may be a lot more proactive, or this current crop, there may be more coming forward as they see that people in their constituencies genuinely want to know more about this and its implications for humanity.
Well, I was going to say that all of these things that you've mentioned are part and parcel of the UFO, UAP phenomenon, always have been. And those are the extra boxes in Pandora's box that people are going to demand be opened, or they're just going to open themselves all by themselves. Don't you think?
Well, that's the wild card, isn't it? At a certain point, some group of them may say the equivalent of enough already. You've had 100 years to get used to this, or however many, and we're here, get used to the fact, and do something undeniable that nobody will be able to talk their way around.
Right.
It fascinates me, and I run up against it regularly, that in this day and age, within the great debate, within the world of UFO studies, formal and informal, there are people that adamantly feel that even the possibility of an extraterrestrial hypothesis and visitations from others is absurd, that that's absolutely loopy. And it reminds me of when I was working on the paper for Denver, going back to good old Project Sign, the Air Force's first official study of the UFO phenomena issued, as I recall, in February of 1948. A lot of it is kind of bureaucratic goings on and rather dry reading. But then you come to a part where they're saying, if there is such a civilization that can travel here, a reason, or the reason, may be that 2 years ago, remembering this was written in 1947, they observed the detonation of a nuclear device on Earth, something that could easily be, you know, studied from or observed out there. And even our basic cracking of that code with our unstable, violent psychology, mankind, makes us a person of interest, as they say in law enforcement circles. And what my point being was that above all else, we should expect to see them now based on the time it would take them to get here. And I had to laugh because that phrase says only based on our most advanced notions of travel, which are basically piston driven, fuel, you know, nuclear fusion travel is still very much theoretical. But they figured it would have to take at least 2 years to get from wherever they were to where we are, which is kind of naive because we have no idea. You know, we have theoretical physicists who talk about folding time or moving through wormholes or whatever stuff I'm completely unequipped to discuss. But
I think I am. I think I am, Peter. I've said many times on my show.
That, go for it.
I've witnessed them coming through a vortex, a wormhole. My whole family witnessed that. That's what got me started in the UFO phenomenon. Right. And I realized that, you know, they can't get here from there because we can't get there from here. Well, I saw them. I saw them through that hole in the sky.
They got here somehow.
They got here somehow. I need to take one more break in this show to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with researcher and author, Mr. Peter Robbins. Okay. Peter, at this congressional hearing, they like to say that they like to use the expression insufficient data. when it came to proving the ET hypothesis, insufficient data. With all this data we've collected to date, how do you think they can make that claim? And just chuckle.
I think to somebody who is a non-believer, no amount of evidence is proof.
Right.
To somebody who believes, what isn't even credible evidence to a 101 science class is evidence to them because they have faith. Mm-hmm. And so we have those two dissonant aspects going at each other. again, we're now really right at within a day or two. I take that back. On or about July 1st or 2nd, the crash at Roswell occurred. Mm-hmm. And I have seen enough evidence for myself. Then again, I worked for the city for a number of years. I visited there many times. I've done what I consider my own due diligence and research. I've spent time with people who I consider the most respectable researchers in the field. And I think that something genuinely anomalous crashed. Mm-hmm. But I hear people say, well, there's nothing except for anecdotal evidence. It's all witnesses and you can't trust witnesses. Well, you read
a lot of people in prison because of eyewitness testimony.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, the naysayers will say, well, you know, there's a car crash. And everybody that's a witness remembers something else. They're in shock. They were looking the other way. Yeah. They have their own little venues, conscious or unconscious, their own agendas to satisfy. But they all saw something. And Witness to Roswell and Children of Roswell, I think two of the most important witness-driven books ever written about anything, in this case by Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, two of the leading, most respected researchers in the field, for me, are absolutely essential reading for folks that want a better sense of what backs this up. But to cite one physical piece of evidence that's usually ignored is in that humiliating series of photographs of the Roswell Army Airfield's 509th Bomb Wing's intelligence officer, Major Jesse Marcel, who recovered personally object, you know, metal debris from the crash field, and was photographed with it. We've never seen those photos, but the next day was forced to pose with tremendous humiliation.
Right.
With pieces of a Mogul weather balloon, and that became the cover story. That those pictures were taken by a news photographer named James Bond. I forget his last name. His middle name was Bond. This is many years before Ian Fleming thought of the James Bond novel. James Bond, I'll think of it, using a big professional newspaper Graflex, which have very high resolution. And there is, in a series of the pictures, General Roger Ramey, one of the godfathers of the cover-up, holding a telegram, a cablegram. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's just, you know, a little fuzzy thing in the photograph. Until some years ago, James Bond Johnson, I think is his name, when technology caught up, and they were able to actually enlarge and read a good part of that telegram. And there are key words like crash, like saucer. They're right there. Nobody has doctored that photograph. There is no reference to balloon or to mogul or to anything of this nonsensical, insulting cover-up.
There is
for me,
bodies.
This is a perfect example of something you could take to court.
Right.
But it's relegated to the zone of nowhere by those who have no interest in, you know, again, as Stanton Friedman used to say, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's already made up.
Right. One congressman suggested that suggested criminalizing civilians and civilian groups like MUFON for investigating and exposing evidence of UAP incidents. What do you say to that?
I can't really say what I'll say to that on your radio show.
Oh.
But how dare they?
How dare they?
And these are citizens and many other organizations and independent people like myself who have been doing this for decades. And screw them. Again, I think certain people have gotten a little too close to the truth in a sense that will embarrass the establishment,
right,
the official secret keepers.
Right.
You're talking before about how this might all come undone on its own. If, yes, you know, kind of a wilder scenario is that they simply make themselves apparent. Mm. But perhaps, although, again, people will, that don't want to take it seriously will immediately say it's forged, it's fabricated, it's photoshopped, end of story for them. But like some kind of equivalent of the Daniel Ellsberg Pentagon Papers, or Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Or for me, a very intriguing thing is there are photos more on the surface of the moon than Mars that show truly anomalous things and what appear to be non-natural formations, either the remains of or active building, mining, stuff like that. Again, the world of photography has been changed forever by the world of digital photography. And in the old days, I remember when I got involved in the 70s, one of my first mentors pointing out a fabrication to me. For me, the standard was a 10-power magnifying glass of a UFO shape that had been cut out of paper and glued down on a photograph. And with a good magnifying glass, you could actually see the cut edge of the paper.
Yeah.
You can't do that anymore, you know.
I know.
It's all so sophisticated.
Right.
But there may come that possibility in future of a genuine, undeniable, unassailable information body that will change things. Maybe not.
Let's hope. Also, according to Scott Bray, Air Force pilots have never attempted to hail these UAP. You remember Truman's directive to shoot them down.
Yeah.
The unknowns refused to answer their hail.
Yep.
Yeah. So I don't know how they could say that.
And you know, I mean, if you want to get a response, you need to initiate it.
Yeah. Yeah. And these two top Pentagon officials denied official knowledge of the Maelstrom nuclear missile incident, where 10 of our Minuteman missiles were rendered inoperable in the presence of a UAP. Shouldn't the details of that incident have been paramount interest to the Pentagon and DOD?
Of course, but that's where we need to classify that, because it's a matter of national security. For me, substitute the term national insecurity. If the stuff comes out, we're going to have egg on our face. We're going to look like we've been covering things up, which of course we are, and have been for decades, but we don't need to be reminded of that. So that's classified.
I think that ship has sailed, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, they got egg on our face already.
Well, no question. And more, as we look harder at the history of lying, dismissal, deception, pseudoscience, it goes on and on. I thought sometime since the 80s about one scenario. I think it's very science fiction-y, and it's based on a science fiction premise that would leave all doubt aside and kind of taking the idea of, well, why don't they just land on the White House lawn and be done with it?
Yeah.
Well, anybody that has ever seen the wonderful 1951 movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, knows what happens if you land across the street from the White House. You get shot.
Yeah.
But there was a miniseries in the 80s that was remade I don't know, 5-6 years ago, more money, but for me, no more convincing, except for the opening premise. And the opening of this particular story, for me, was as wonderful in terms of imagination and quality as anything out of Jules Verne or H.G. Wells or Robert Heinlein or any of the great science fiction writers, Gene Roddenberry. It was called V, as in victory. And some of your listeners, I'm sure, remember either the first or second one. One morning, we all get up and we learn that, I think it's over the 50 biggest cities in the world, 1 mile up, there are 50 motherships hanging 1 mile across. Mm-hmm. Game over. End of story. Goodbye, denial. Goodbye, ridicule. They're here. Mm-hmm. Then for me, it kind of degenerates into, first, they all look like, you know, 1980s blow-dried models. Mm-hmm. And everybody, you know, they're kind and they're thoughtful and they want to help us cure cancer and hunger and all that. But of course, underneath their beautiful latex suits and their latex skin, they're monsters that, among other things, as I recall, eat us. And then it becomes every World War II resistance movie you've ever seen.
Right.
But in the B and C level. Right. But I thought, boy, that would put an end to things, wouldn't it?
All of these movies about extraterrestrials coming to Earth, they're the bad guys, and we have to fight them off. It's Independence Day all over again, you know?
Right, yeah, kick E.T.'s ass. Well, of course, there are the other ones. There are, you know, you have E.T. You do have that subdivision of they're nice. They're nicer than we are. They want to help.
Those
Coma.
Are few and far between, aren't they?
Yeah.
Those are few and far between. But go ahead.
But, you know, that whole macho ethic of, and, you know, again, the cover-up in terms of the military thinking is, as they say to a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right, right.
To a surgeon, the cure to anything is do surgery. To the Pentagon, they're not in business for goodness and light.
Yeah.
They make stuff that explodes and kills people.
That's it.
And that's their business. And the unknown is always something to fear.
Mm-hmm.
We do have actually increasingly verbal and active movements on both sides of the argument. One who feels overwhelmingly that these beings, in terms of that subdivision, who interface with human beings, are good. The experiences that individuals who are having contact with them report overwhelmingly are connecting, a deeper appreciation of reality, transcendence, positive ideas of evolving for humanity. And the other group is, we can't trust them. We got to keep developing new weapons.
Yeah.
The whole idea of the Space Force, did we really need that? And it's simply a way of saying we are preparing to have wars in space.
That's right.
Because that's what we guys do. And I say we guys, man, I don't say mankind, because women don't come up with this stuff. It's us.
Well, mankind includes women, you know.
It does, but they're not the ones that are involved in these scenarios overwhelmingly.
And they said that they were going to have classified hearings after that particular hearing in Congress. And do you think that the truth would have finally come out to Congress in that meeting?
I think it is inevitable, at least to people who are open to it and who are genuinely keeping their ear to the ground, who are doing their best to not become part of the belief system. To, you know, for any rational person, and I include every open-minded skeptic, let's face it, David, you and I have to be among the most pronounced skeptics, because we've reached a point some time back where we know, in so many words, that we seem to be dealing with something real here. All the more reason we have to be careful, because we have already accepted the premise.
Right.
Debunkers are something else. and it's an interesting word. It denotes a word going back to the 19th century of that's a lot of bunk, hooey, hokum. To debunk, that word I think first appears in print, as far as I know, in 1952 in the CIA's Robertson panel report, and I'd be interested in anybody can find an earlier reference. But these are people who have the intellectual arrogance and audacity to say that they know that this can't be. Why? Well, just because it can't. Therefore, it's something else. Therefore, you're wrong. And it's my job to give you explanations for stuff it could be. Mm-hmm. That, for me, is not acceptable. Mm-hmm. Skepticism is a must. Debunking is just a tactic of naysayers.
Right. So, bottom line, do you feel that congressional hearings constitute disclosure, or it was just another more of move along, there's nothing to see here?
I would say it constitutes what I would call creeping disclosure. And I think that for those people, I think the leading figure in this work, doing tremendous work, is Stephen Bassett, who is tirelessly leading the charge. A lot of people think he's naive to think there can ever be such a thing as disclosure. I have tremendous admiration for Steve, and I think it's happening, but it's a process. I think, more dramatic minds are waiting for the announcement that never came from President Truman. And I don't think any world leader is quite ready to put themselves on the block with that one.
No. So what do you what do you have in store for you after the after August, let's say?
Labor Day weekend, almost every UFO-related conference, like every conference and event the past couple of years because of COVID, has been either canceled or delayed. And one of my favorite conferences takes place in Exeter, New Hampshire. I think it's now about 10 years, not counting the last 2 years when they've been on hiatus, on Labor Day. I'm very proud to be a co-founder of that event, and I'll be heading up to New Hampshire for that. Otherwise, I'm working away on a couple of writing projects, one or two possible things that may result in broadcast work. And like you, I have a weekly radio show, 2 hours every Monday night, 2-hour live interview conversations with leading figures in UFO studies and the paranormal, and other folks as well. Mm-hmm. It's called Meanwhile Here on Earth. It's on KGRA Digital Broadcasting. And it's 7 to 9 Eastern Standard Time. And as you know, lining up your guests and working on your questions it ain't a full-time job, but it's part of what we do every week, isn't it?
It does take time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does take time. And book deals. You mentioned book deal. Coming out with a book, another book?
I'm working away on several manuscripts. Nothing that's going to come out this year. I hope to have at least one new book out next year, and I'm not going to go into detail about it. It is UFO related. Mm-hmm. And I'm again not working on it full time right now, but it's coming along nicely. And I've got working notes together for a book on a non-UFO related subject that I've wanted to do for years, and hope that I can keep getting back into the writing and publishing habit.
Well, Mr. Peter Robbins, I want to thank you so much for joining us again. And when that book comes out, maybe we can get on the air and talk about that. How's that?
I'll be honored to, Dave. And great being back with you here. And all the best to you, and looking forward to our next get-together.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage and scroll down to We Are Not Alone and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archived shows. Please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.